you when I called AA.
50 years, and I've been introduced thousands of times. And I want to say, that way, I didn't have any booze, ran through the woods, up over the tree, down the hill, through the day, came out. I knew there's nothing you can do about them. It's pleasant. You can cough. Little boy, my name being Lynn, L-I-N-N, I can bring them up and write them down. Don't worry about them, they're gone. But how lovely that my mother, she died called alcoholism and drug addiction, was with the pounds, had three, boy, she had just had one little bad tooth, they put braces on her teeth. And I said, well, I guess I'm going to kiss you goodnight now. She said, okay, we both had braces. I can remember going out and, you know, somebody in the family that I was living with saying, here, that's an airplane. You run out, the older people will remember. They had a restaurant. I drank the rest of it. Pretty soon I was at 98 pounds. People kept saying, what about your father and mother? Dad and mother. I had never said, hi, mother. Hi, dad. Hello, mom. How are you? And I kept saying, gee, I got it right. I had forgotten now. I forgot all about it. All I thought about was someday I am going to. The guy that was driving the truck had a bottle. I'm 17 and a half, 18. Angel Lodge in the south rim of the Grand Canyon. Also a pearl diver. That means you do the you can look at the wall. You can look at somebody next to you. Every moment of our life, we are choosing. But are we making a choice with, as I was doing then, emotions? Or are you making a choice with your intellect? If big things rule you, then you're going to lose. If you let your intellect, you're going to win. It's through my portion of the war, as many people did, but I said, it's because of the war. It's because I didn't have any father or mother. That's without going to a party. Oh, yes, like all of us, I tried a beer. But, all right, we'll have... And that's a very potent drug. And, yes, it was getting. We got out a pistol that he had. We decided to play Russian roulette. Something else that has happened to me. Where is... Doesn't the Lord know that I need him? Allow you to live in this moment. Joints. Hereford, Texas. Mean, I think I'm funny. I ain't laughing. There's 5 days a week in television. Some know who I am. Some do not. I have been in many cities. I was in... Drink your milk like Barnaby. I still got them. I kept a room... I was in the... get more money for the children. Got to go to college. I'm drinking, taking... Every place I go, they chase me. There's this one image up there and me. And I'm still feeling sorry for myself. I mean, they got an ambulance. They took me to a place called Lutheran... David. Felt so bad that when they let me out, I went over to West 25th Street and got drunk. $1 million contract... The next thing I remember, Florida Keys. This is a good-sized boat. And I remember a cap and everything, and I order a couple of drinks. And
hiya, kids, drink your water.
Yes. Said, no, yourself out. I had been going to psychiatrists. And I had psychiatrists saying, I never looked at life like, and I lost, you know, we all, there are those dreams of a baseball player. You don't dream of riding minor leagues, eating in lousy places, going nowhere. When you dream of hitting the home run, what many times, and strapped because I was having, I called a friend of mine who was in AA. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. He came and took me to a hotel. to the arena. Hey, it took a half a gallon of Vitalis and a Ringling Brothers circus. Oh, we'll get back to the other instrument.
Well, a few cities I haven't had a chance to get to, so I was excited about coming up here. And
I go up to Rosemary Hall once in a while and talk to the folks, and you know, we've got to have humor, boy. You writing this down, Chuck? It's funny. The music coming out of that drawer. Boy, I... And I went and opened up your ears. I was afraid of every single moment. One beautiful man by the name of Father John used to say fears, F-E-A-R, as much as living in the present moment of now. Not feeling sorry for myself. And I thought I was a gutsy guy. Mr. Macho, nothing could beat. Drank a fifth of vodka. I won't ever talk to you again. My son said I'll stick it out. His mother had been gone. Got out of the car and says, gentlemen, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you please take me somewhere to sleep? Don't ever ask a state patrol fellowship this is. Where else in this world can we go and reach out and say, I need? Where else can we go from one of the blackest holes that anyone can get into, whether you are when you're lonely? When you are help, I have got my self-respect back. Do yes, I can love. Yes, I can care. Yes, I can feel sad. And I am very happy in it. Like what I'm doing. And I'm their problem. Not mental problems. I have had them. But maybe you can get to him. We can't reach him with everything we're trying. We can't touch him. He just... And on this day at Chautauqua, I can't...
Now, as I start talking, if you think I talk funny, that is because I do.
Of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. So anything you hear up here, a couple Al-Anons? Well, there was an Al-Anon golfer, and she was out in the golf course one day, and it's okay. And said, well, what's your second wish? Well, my second wish is that I want to play... Yeah, when I was drinking alcohol, let me tell you, there's some women that... And speakers who get up and say they're not going to talk about drinking very much anymore really scare me, because about 55 minutes into this talk, there was drinking and there was drinking and drink. My ego uses to separate me from you. You see, because we all do different things when we take a drink, and the reason is, if you're a real alcoholic, the drink bars. None of that has anything to do with why I'm an alcoholic. Born and raised back in Iowa, a book one time and said, Norwegian humor and other myths, 16 years old. And I drank till I was 36 when God removed the obsession for me to drink. Just all drunks. I was bound to... By the time I got through the work, I had to go to 7 states to make amends, and that's expensive and takes a lot of time, but alcohol took me to California, and my life, she said, Mark, you need to quit drinking or something's going to happen. I said, no, I don't. It's already happened. You're not in my life. 2 powers in my life, and one's alcohol and one's God. And alcohol is the only thing. Bud talked all about it last night. I drank for effect, and I'll tell you, I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, and when I drink, I'm not that way. And there's a paragraph on that, and alcohol treated that. And I drank alcohol for 20 years and expected an alcoholic to get something out of that book on his own. Would be like me parking a jet outside this hotel, giving you 164 books that I suffer from and have nothing to do with not consider anything. I would use an answer to not consider anything, and I've learned what I call the path of consideration. And that is when I'm asking, just know that I'm getting worse inside. And so what I did is I held him accountable and I went and got another sponsor. Some of you can relate. This group will also be given power, peace, 3 years, but I didn't know that's where I was. So I went and I called Don and I went over to see him and I told him, came from this. I got more distance between me and alcohol than I've ever had before. I got today to let me share with you experiences that I've had. All that's working the steps, and then he asked me, and he stopped me and said, whoa, wait a minute. When I ask you a yes or no question, I'd like a yes or no response, so let me try this one more time with you. Then he said, you've never been in recovery. Now, I didn't like that. He didn't care that I didn't like that. So he and I started that journey, and we completed. And I heard enough times in AA that you work 1 through 9, 11, 10, 11, 12, and I bought that. I went into a severe depression. Now, I got to tell you a little something about that experience. What I did with the steps in 1994 has absolutely nothing to do today with my experience with the God. And in one place it says, Mark, it's easy to let up in the spiritual program of action. Well, I knew by then my spiritual program of action was all 12 steps. I sat down. Today I work the steps because I love God. I do not work the steps because out of fear. I do not work the steps because of the unmanageability of my life. It is due that, I'll tell you the noose around my neck. I look to me and alcohol is. It doesn't care what my educational level is. A woman who I've never written inventory on a drink. He had eaten a full meal. He wasn't hungry at all. He wasn't angry at anybody. He just wasn't lonely. And he got a full night's sleep. I don't think Halt has anything to do with it. Now I go back into my experience to find out my truth. If my butt even hints of falling off, I go drink. See, I would hear these things, they would come in, and I would lay them aside anywhere in the big book. They've had to go away because of me. Nothing outside of me will ever treat this. It's an internal condition, it's the reason bad, Mark. You ever had someone say, boy, you get mad over such a little once again. And I see that it's a spiritual illness. And I see that only God can treat it. For brief periods of time, take the worst of men you've got to make. The person you harm the most. Ask you what's wrong with me, and I need power. Aspiration of a drowning man. And a power greater than yourself. And maybe, Mark, consider something else. Can this power experience with? I have relationships with people today, men and women, that 2 years ago, power, once again, lack of power. For me, it's going to be everything. Why? Because of what I looked at in step one. And then I love what the book says. The country trying to find God. And you all tell me he's deep down within me? What a deal. Right here, right now. Anyhow, in the big book, I'm going to find this power. Before I realize there's a requirement I got to meet before I can make a look at my life. And I once again see some self-seeking, self-pity. Pictures always work good for me. I suffer consequences today. I think Martha said it well last night. I love what she said. She said, you know, I love freedom, and if I'm blocked from you, I'm not free. And that's my mark. You got to get rid of this selfishness or you're going to die. It says it kills you. Now see, I had to see the hook between my selfishness and dying an alcoholic death, and I know exactly what the hook is today. I don't care how long I've been sober, I got it in me, here's what's gonna happen. When I'm selfish, I'm playing God. You're not gonna do what I want. I'm gonna get resentful. When I'm resentful, I'm blocked from God. That will not keep me in a state of comfortableness. The obsession to drink will come back, and I'll take a drink and die an alcoholic death. I have God's help, and I know now why I need God's help. Because I'm chained to Mark and there's nothing I can do about it. And then it tells me how I'm going to get God's help. It says, Mark, you're going to quit playing God. And it tells me why I'm going to do that. It says, Mark, if you playing God doesn't work. What you need to do, Mark, is let God be God and you be Mark. You want to talk about freedom? Let God be God and I just be His child. And then I sit with my third step decision. God's going to direct my life, and I'm the actor. God's the principal. I'm the agent. God's going to be my employer, and God's my loving father, and I'm his child. And I sit with that for 5 minutes, and I imagine what it's going to be like to go through the rest of my life with the creator of the universe. See, I want to tell you something. People ask me whether I speak or anything else I'm ever asked to do. Aren't you afraid? No, I'm not afraid. God's 20 feet tall, and I got my hand around him. He's got his arm on my shoulder. And the God of my understanding will let nothing touch me except what he wants to touch me. And if it touches me, he'll give me the resources to get through it. You see, that's the God I've come to know and love. And then I did that third step prayer, and then I wrote some inventories, a four-column resentment inventory. Interesting thing about those resentment inventories. Second column's the truth, right? You write the truth in the second column. I particularly like it when I've either wrote it or I'm working with somebody. Second column is she left me, right? At the same time, but it is, isn't it? And so I wrote the erythema inventory, and I wrote a fear inventory, and I wrote a sex inventory. And then we drew names in a hat. I want to mention something else about inventory. Book is very clear what I do inventory for. I'm going to find the truth. I'm going to face and be rid of the things that have me blocked from God. How do you not get excited about inventory? I do not present to people that inventory is some horrendous thing. For me, it's more like this. If you got children, if you ask your child to go clean your room, they'll balk at it. But if you say to your child, tell you what, you go down to your room, you take everything out of your room you don't want, and I'll take you down to Neiman Marcus and buy you all new stuff, that kid will run you over. Well, that's what happens when I write inventory. We did, since there were six of us working together, we threw names in the hat, we made an agreement. Names in 1 week, I did 3 5-steps. Now, I got to tell you something about that. I started doing that last year based on the experience of a man. And I had no experience with multiple 5-steps in the same inventory until he suggested I try it. And I want to tell you something. It's one of the greatest things I've ever done. See, I didn't know something. I didn't know that the more people that knew how flawed I am, the more at peace I was, because I don't have to pretend to be something I'm not, and I never knew that. So I did those 3 5-steps with 3 different people. And I did... What are the behaviors that you do, Mark, based on these defects? And I sit with that. And then I did a 7-step prayer, and I made my list of amends, and I had 17 amends. 4 of those amends were at graves back in Iowa. And over the 4th of July, I drove back to Iowa, which is where I was born and raised. And I went and made an amend at the gravesite of that grandmother, whose funeral I missed. And in that same cemetery was a great aunt, and I made an amend to her. And a good friend of mine who died in 1968, and I made an amend to him. And a lady who was in my life for a little while in the early 60s, she had been killed in a car wreck, and I made an amend to her. Book says if I can't see people, I write them an honest letter. So I write letters to the spirits of these people, and I read them to somebody that I just hated. Beat me a lot, I hated him. Embarrassed me in public over and over and over again. And I was able to make amends to him while he was alive, but I wasn't able to say much. It's just the way my family was. You don't talk about stuff. So I never felt complete with that. And he died at 86. He got up one morning and his aorta burst. And his death certificate doesn't say he died of alcoholism, but he died of alcoholism. And about 3 years ago, I went up to Colorado, and he was buried at the Veterans Cemetery up there. And if you've ever been there, they all look the same. They're all just white crosses everywhere. And I pulled in there, and I didn't have a clue where he was, and I said a prayer, and I got directed to his grave, and I read that letter to him. And I'll tell you what, I got free that morning. And my father resides with me all the time. Whenever I think of him, it's about tremendous love and respect. So I finished all those amends but 3. I want to tell you some other things that I never knew in my life. I didn't know. I did a lot of blackout drinking, and when I did blackout drinking, I loved chasing women. I love women. And in the process of all that blackout drinking, I could not remember a lot of one-night stands and other things. And last year when I came out of meditation, I picked up a pad of paper and I couldn't remember names, but God gave me a videotape replay of a lot of that blackout drinking, and I got situations that were crystal clear to me, and I knew I'm supposed to do something with them. So I wrote letters to the spirits of all these women, and I found a woman in the program, and over a period of time I read those letters to her. And here's what I want to tell you about that. The very next day after that experience, my relationship with all women taught me is that if there's harm in my past I haven't cleaned up, it's connected to me right now, right here today. You know, Martha said that again last night. I want freedom. I want to be here. And when I do these steps and I have this relationship with God, then you see, I can be here. I do a lot of work with meditation. I sponsor a lot of people. Tell you something about sponsorship. Every single human being that God has put in my life to work with, whether it be a man or a woman, that's a gift He's given to me out of His love for me. I don't care how they look at me. I know that's about His love for me. And there's nothing I enjoy better. Big Book says, Mark, you can recover and you're given the power to help others. That's what God gives me the power for. He doesn't give me the power to be rich or famous. I'm here on borrowed time. He gives me the power to help you. That's it. And when I'm not helping you, I choke on this thing. So that's what it's all about for me. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this program because it got me in touch with a God who loves me in ways that I can't. resides within me. And I got that through 20 years of drinking alcohol and coming to you. Yeah, I'm willing to do that. I'll close with one thing, and it's all I've wanted my whole life. Here's what a relationship with God did for me. It came about through working these steps and being a part of this fellowship. I have never read about another human being, nor will I ever read about who I'd rather be than me, Mark Houston. And there has never been another group of people that I've ever been with or ever will be than I would rather be with than you. And there's never been a place in my life that I've ever been or could ever read about that I'd rather be for me. Because the only place God is right here, right now, wherever I am. And I don't have to drink alcohol. And the book told me that the best years of my life lay ahead of me, and that's been my experience. I'm going to close with a prayer. The 11th step gives me permission to go out and seek out religious people and see where they're right. 2 years ago, I was directed to read a lot of the books by a Trappist monk named Thomas Merton. And the spiritual tool he gave me was meditation. But it's called a prayer of surrender. It says, "My Lord God, I have no idea where I'm going. I do not see the road ahead of me. I cannot know for certain where it will end, nor do I really know myself. And the fact that I think I'm following your will does not mean I'm actually doing so. But I believe the desire to please you does in fact please you, and I hope I have that desire in all that I am doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me through the right road, though I may know nothing about it. Therefore, I will trust you always, God, though I may seem to be lost and in the shadow of death. I will not fear, for you are ever with me, and you will never leave me to face my peril alone." God bless you.
Because I'm a born and bred Texan with a true Texas twang. Before I begin...
Hi, everyone. I'm Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. I really want to thank Wally and all of those of you on the convention committee and all those who came before you on the convention committee to pave the way all these years, one day at a time, for this moment and for this weekend. I think this is a weekend about love affairs. I've been noticing everybody who's in love. Somebody just told me that he and his wife are spending their 23rd wedding anniversary. I believe that's what he said, 23rd wedding anniversary here this weekend. And I thought, my God. What a beautiful way to celebrate the love that has been able to flow through us because of this program. I would like to also thank you for the beautiful gift. Ivy's in it, and that was just wonderful. Dave and Cheryl have just made themselves so gracious and available to us, as all of you have, really. I can't say enough thank you. It's such an honor. Wally, this is going to be a weekend I will always remember. Yeah. I knew it. You all have dirty minds. I should have known it right off the bat. Friday night, I was trying to weave my way, and then I came across a man who had his arms on both chairs, his hands on both chairs next to him on either side. And I said, "Can I just get through? And I promise I'll give you your chair back. I won't try to take it." And he said, he lifted his arm up, and I got through. I hustled poor George through. And I turned around to him, and I said, "Okay, you can put your hand back there." Naturally, somebody heard it, made a big deal about it. I suppose you'd like to meet old George and poor George. This is poor George.
Stand up, George.
I'm 58. I was born in 43. George is only 46. So you can see that it's been kind of rough being married to me. Ed knows why. He caught me trying to do Armando's job for him. I'm originally from, Chicago, and then Duluth, Minnesota. So I'm going to tell you an Ole and a Sven joke. Ole and Sven decided they were going to go to the tavern. All right, good God. Anyway, they got there, and you know what happened. They got very, very intoxicated. All of a sudden, Sven was looking around, and he couldn't find his wife, Hilda. Not only that, Hilda.
It's catchy, isn't it?
No, I had it before I got here. Not all shrooms, nothing. Out the front door, nothing. Out the back door. And he was just about to come back in because there was nothing out there when he heard a funny sound coming from the back of his pickup truck. And he went over there and, oh, my God. He staggered back through the tavern in the back hallway, and the bartender looked up, saw him coming, and he says, Sven, you are drunk. Sven said, you think I'm drunk? You should see Ollie. He thinks he's me. Now, just as a way to qualify, I will tell you that I'm the Hilda in that story, and I never knew that I was not a Sven. You could have fooled me. The other thing is that that's kind of my story. I mean, it's a story of mistaken identification. I'm a woman who has had terror ever since I was 2 years. Now, I thought I was terrified until last night in the lobby I met a young man, and I said, holy mackerel, you must be scared to death. And he looked at me, he said, why? I said, because your hair is standing straight up on end. Several. What a beauty. My sponsor taught me one God, many faces, one life common to all. That's why I love to go somewhere where I'm not from, because I see God. Every time I look around, I see Sherry and I see our birth grandmother. Now, I want to say something about that. We are an adoptive family, George and I, and parents of four children. And their mother is still a child who had children. And their grandmother is still a child, a young woman. And so, Sherry, you don't remind me of a grandmother in terms of age. You remind me of the, oh, that's wonderful, of the love that shows forth through these eyes here in this room. Thank you. I'm sober since January 15th, 1972, thanks to the grace of God and the power of the 12 steps, as well as the fellowship of the Spirit. I have two home groups. One is the Mustard Seed Women's Group on Monday evening at 5:30, and the other is the Rise and Shine Group at 6:30 a.m. And that both of those are wonderful meetings. And so, when you're in Great Falls, Montana, or in the area, just look up Midge Lehner, L-E-H-N-E-R, in the phone book. You can stay with us, and you can go to meetings with us. That's an open invitation. I wasn't in trouble. I'm Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. I was not in trouble, as I say, until about the second year of my life. up until then, I think I just came out of my mom's chute. Eager, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and I just knew that life, this world, was my oyster. And every the age of two, I made my first decision based on self. And that self-centered fear that this was all fine and good, but it wouldn't last if I didn't. Now, if you're the first child born to a mom and a dad, and your mom is already skittish, she already knows she's got a handful, having been married to this man, and she's never had a baby before, so I didn't want to bother her. In fact, I just said, so I think loves me unconditionally, approves of me 100% of the time in 100% way, then I'll be okay. The selfishness, the gall, of course, so he didn't even know that was his job. I didn't know that he was simply a human being trying to do the best he could. And so we were off to a bang. I said to my sister and my mother in the living room of my young, always have a war going on. And she looked at me like I was crazy. I was 37 at the time and 9 years sober and clean. And she said, Mary, you were the apple of your father's eye. And I knew she was telling me the truth, that I had been lying to myself up until then. Changed everything. Also, the first, fourth, and fifth step I did changed everything. When I wrote down the fact that I resented my father because he was uncooperative, unaccepting, intolerant, judgmental, fifth step process, that the only way I could identify or recognize any of that was because it was within me. Which is another really hard thing for me still. I can remember one of the first speakers I ever heard in Duluth, Minnesota, a woman with black hair. Just, you probably know her. I can't remember her name, but I know that she was well known. And she said, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to move beyond having my feelings hurt or looking for your approval. And so she gave me permission, I think, right then, along with my sponsor, to be a human being before I'm anything else. And that has saved my bacon so many times, to tell you the truth. I mean, I understand that the fact of my alcoholism is probably the most powerful, important fact of my life today, in addition to the fact of a loving God that works and operates in a daily way and gives me 12 steps to follow based on spiritual principles so that I can meet whatever comes today. And the fact of them was a human being. That was the other thing I lied to myself about. I thought I was the worst at it from the age of 2 on up. To excitement. Because something happened to me when I got excited. It was like a tension reliever. And so that was the beginning of learning to live from crises to crises. And then I suppose the next, I'm trying to think the first time I was sexual, either, you know, self-pleasuring or with another person. And I think, I'm trying not to lie. I think it was before I had my first drink. So I learned that that kind of a sexual pleasure was absolute another unhealthy dependence. Not, it wasn't unhealthy. It was just the way I sought it that got a little unclever. So you can see that when I reached for my first drink, it's only 25 after 6. Oh. When I reached for my first drink, something absolutely miraculous and magical happened. And I don't know if it was a first, if I had one or two beers that day. We had moved from Chicago up to the northern suburb of Wilmette. I was now at New Trier High School in the middle of my freshman year. I think that's what made me alcoholic. And I've heard other people say, that is very traumatic for us. You know. Oh. Anyway. I just wanted to be included. I couldn't figure out why people were kind of giving there where we moved. All of the girls had beautiful little peroxide streaks in their hair and a little flip up or a little flip down, and they all wore dyed-to-match wool angora skirt and sweaters in pastels, either pink. Men were jocks, and I had black. I had my black sweater buttoned backwards, was on my back, the buttons, and a long skirt, and I walked, you know.
Oh,
all of a sudden one day I'm walking home because there was a this week of tests, and they had breaks in between each test. So I'm walking home, and a carload of people come by, and they say, "Hey, we're going to a party included in that new community." And I said, "You bet. Oh, yeah." And so we went down to an Al Capone casino that was in ruins on Lake Michigan. And somebody broke out a beer and handed it to me. Did I drink too? I don't know. But I do know this, that when I drank that beer, not only that, but I was lisp. On top of that, I didn't give a rip what you thought of me. In fact, I wasn't sure that I approved of you. In my life up until that moment, and I knew intuitively that it was something, another lie, I could control. That whenever life got a little rough, I could just take a little bit of that liquid courage, liquid serenity bliss. And that's what I made my commitment to. That was really my very first real love affair. And all went well for a couple of weeks. And then I started doing silly things, you know, really silly things. I can remember being sexual when I didn't intend to be sexual, running away from home, making an absolute commotion, developing these terrible tales about my wicked father. I'll tell you, our kids are getting even for my father. They're wicked tales about my father. And I just created more and more stuff so that I could justify continuing to take a drink. And then you wouldn't get on my back, because you were starting to get on my back. You were starting to not complain or criticize, but you were pointing some things out. And, of course, I got good about that. You'd say, "Oh, you were really funny last night until about 10. And I'd say, "Oh, you thought so, huh? What did you like the best?" And they say, "Well, when you got on top of the table and started dancing, that was pretty hilarious." "Oh, uh-huh. But then when you jumped on Harry's shoulders and broke his back, that wasn't funny." So I learned to interrogate you to find out what I had done, because I was having blackouts on a regular basis. I was drinking more, and I didn't know that was a red flag for alcoholism. I just thought I was just too cool to move. I could drink all of you under the table. And little did I know. But towards the end of my drinking, I would take a little thimbleful of vodka, and I would be totally drunk on that little, because my body wasn't metabolizing anything. I was a daily drinker, and I drank a lot. And my body was no longer metabolizing. So I was really pitiful. The other thing, too, is I must tell you, I was in professional circles, it's called a hero child, because I was the first to make my parents a family. And I was also a scapegoat because I was developing alcoholism. And so I was always running around asking if you'd like, a cup of coffee. Can I get you anything? Do you want me to help you get into the next room? Can I do your homework assignment for you? What can I do for you? I'm just here to please. I'm just here to be helpful. And I kept getting absolutely crucified everywhere I go, which has also been a pattern that I have experienced up to, including through today. So I kind of get kind of praised, and it's just an identity crisis I'm going through. I am a chronic relapser. I would have a day or a minute or a week or maybe even a month. Never any longer than that before I'd be back drinking again. My first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, a man who was deeply in love with me, a man who was so in love with me that he told me he thought I had alcoholism. He was a year ahead of me at the University of Maryland School of Social Work, and he said, "I think you need some help, and I'm going to make sure you get to a meeting." And he took me to a meeting. It was in a church basement. And, man, you people were just beautiful. Shiny eyes, great smiles, the enthusiasm, the spirit was just intense. And I said, and I meant it truly, I was so grateful you had found this miracle. And if I ever got that bad, you know, by the time I got back to Alcoholics Anonymous, I believed truly that I was too far gone, that I was too bad, that I was not capable of this beautiful thing, and that I would never, ever be able to get it. you knew differently because you knew that we just live on the basis of hope. We don't know. What do we know? I know nothing. That's the other thing I've lied to myself all my life about. I thought I've known in a place that was an institution. And the first time I was there, this was all about my 15th or 16th treatment center and detox center. And by the time I ended up there the second time, I was there for 6 months. They saw fit. It hurt my feelings. They saw fit to refer me on to a women's halfway house program in Duluth, Minnesota, called the Marty Mann Halfway House. And I called my mother, and I said, Mom, do you know what? They want me to go on up, instead of coming back to Chicago like I did the last time, because you and Dad were having marital difficulties, they want me to go to Duluth, Minnesota, to a halfway house. And she said, oh, Mary, don't you think you've put in enough time? With that, my dad was on the other extension and said, they haven't led you astray yet. I think it's a mighty fine idea. So I knew my goose was cooked. I knew I'd had it. So at about 98 pounds, with skinny hair, gray skin, a falling down alcoholic, I still fall down a lot, by the way, a falling down alcoholic, I went to a halfway house in Duluth, Minnesota, and I was there for another 14 months. So I was institutionalized for 20 months. I know it's hard for you to really even imagine that. You believe me, don't you? Shoo. Anyway, so I had a lot of time, and I'm going to really focus on that a lot this morning. Why? Because that's where the foundation was laid. I mean, it was just an incredible thing. I mean, it was my first year and really my first 2 years that I think have been absolutely the springboard for the rest of my life. And I told myself, of course, and I told you that the problem with me was alcoholism once I got the message of myself. And I almost set my first sponsor straight, Marion. She said that alcoholism is a physical compulsion. No, the treatment center told me alcoholism is a physical compulsion to drink because of a psychological obsession that condemns us to die if we do. Excuse to bring us to our knees to say yes to a spiritual journey we've been trying to avoid. And I said, oh, no, it isn't. It's a psychological obsession matched by... But I was smart. I'm Mensa. I was smart. I just said it to myself. I did not say it out loud. They had been telling me that I was too smart for my own good for a long while. And I really didn't think I could use my mind. I was so terrified of using my mind for so many years in sobriety, which was probably good. I try to use my mind in a healthy way. I suffer from a malady that has attacked me and is waiting to continue to attack me, body, mind, and spirit. And so what you've taught me is that I really need to nurture and to feed. And so I do use my mind within certain parameters, the 12 steps, sponsorship, my home group, living just one day at a time. You know, imagine that. I remember Tommy B. from Winnipeg said, I loved it. He was such a hero of mine. He still is in spirit. And he said he went to Florida. My sponsor said, never mention anybody's name, ever, at the podium. And I said, why not? And she said, because whose names you don't mention will be offended. I said, oh, so I hope I do this right. Anyway, Tommy B. looked around the room, and he saw people with 32 years, 31 years, 27 years, and he said to himself, wouldn't you think that by now they could live life 2 days at a time? No, even they have to live life one day at a time. And that's really kind of a saving my fanny right now. I must tell you that I was so hungry. I was so hungry. I was. And somebody put a pen and a oh, this was a pitiful story, I'll tell you. You already know my father's position on my recovery. Follow directions, he said. And so here I am at this halfway house for alcoholic women. And Dorothy is the director. And she's just loving me and says, I think I was just here long enough for you to come. Now I got to get out of here. Why? Because her three daughters were still furious with her because of her alcoholism. And so she came up and she took over a women's halfway house program where everybody in the house, all 12 women, were absolutely, or 11, furious with her because Lorraine, the founder of the halfway house, had left. And nobody could be furious with Lorraine. It's like you can't be furious with your mother directly. So you do it indirectly. And so everybody was furious with Dorothy because Lorraine had left. It's a little bit like our big dog got neutered because Callie got knocked up by Barney, who was our Basset Beagle Terrier mix little dog. I mean, I'll tell you another thing that makes a lot of sense. Well, there was a lot of commotion. I knew what to do about commotion. Get that big dog neutered. Now you know why I say poor George. I'll tell you another conflicting thing that I cannot even believe to this day. My sponsor, Marion, said to me early in my sobriety, after she took over the directorship of that halfway house program, which was not Alcoholics Anonymous, but where AA was spoken, she said to me, women sponsor women in Alcoholics Anonymous, and men sponsor men. And my sponsor is Chuck C. Well, I couldn't challenge her because I was only a minute and a half sober. And she was quite sober. So, and I had a resentment right from the get-go. You asked me to make sense out of all this. Right from the get-go, be tough on yourself and gentle with others. That was another one that I really hated. So you didn't have a rule book for how to live life. I mean, I kept looking for the right answer. Okay, when this happens, what do you do? Which is how I went through graduate school, by the way. I was drunk. And so make piles. And then I'd get ready to study, and I'd realize that the piles weren't right. So I'd repile. And that's how I've been in sobriety, too. All right? So, anyway, I wrote everything down that she said. I followed her. I just took the pen out of my hands, turn off my light, because I had fallen asleep while I was writing. I still do that. I was on the plane the other day going to Chicago. My mother and my father just have a great relationship. He said to me the other day, he's untreated. He said, your brother and I had a very long talk today, and I've decided, even though it's not my responsibility, I'm going to pay for your mother to live in assisted living. And I said, have you checked it out with her yet? She wasn't buying it one bit. Anyway, I think this was true long before we got children, but certainly since we've gotten children, I usually do not go to sleep the night before I fly because then I have to sort and decide what I'm going to take. If we take a car, I can take everything. But if I have to fly, I have to kind of discern. And so on the way to Chicago 2 months ago, a month and a half ago, I was a little tired. I got on the first plane, and I fell sound asleep. I got on the second plane, and I fell sound asleep after I ordered my cup of coffee. And all of a sudden, I felt something very hot. And I realized that I had dumped my coffee over while I was sleeping. And, you know, you can't make a big deal on an airplane because you know what they think. That you're going to try to cause trouble. So I still drop coffee. I still fall asleep while I'm reading at night. But my favorite time is bedtime. I love it, along with morning, because I get to read. And after, if George wants to fool around, then we've got to do that. But after, but after that, I get to read. And it lasts all of about 2 minutes, you know. I try to help and do my part, and I say, this time, George, I am going to stay awake the whole time and keep you company. And before we're to Belt, Montana, I'm... You know, and he just says, oh, he just gives up. Then when we get to Duluth, we've driven straight through. I get out of the car and I say, oh, my God, I'm so tired. You just don't get good rest in a car. And he's falling over, you know. He is really out for the count. He's driven 22 miles straight. And even though I know the answer, I say to him, what's your problem? A woman said to me the other day, she was talking, and I said to her, do you know what your husband's problem is? And she just lit up, her eyes got that big, and she said, what? She was finally going to get the answer, even though she had been telling me the answer for months. She was finally getting a source. And so I said, the problem with him is that you don't have a life. She trusts me unconditionally. I wouldn't say it to you. I would never say anything like that to you yet. And what I meant was, you know, what did I mean? I meant you don't have a program that's working for you in the now moment. For some reason, you've lied to yourself, and you've told yourself this is not a spiritual journey. You are not in God's lap. You are not enveloped with His love. And so that's your problem. So I went home to George, who is always living on the edge. And I said, do you know what I realized today again? The problem with you is you don't have a life. I mean, I don't have a life. And he said, with all of the graciousness of 29 years of sobriety, are you asking me for a divorce? I said, no, 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 honey. It isn't about you at all. It's about me. And that's what I keep having to learn, that I keep lying to myself and telling me myself, even in sobriety, it's about you. It's never about you. I remember my sponsor, I was sharing this this week, and my sponsor said to me, there are no such thing as personality conflicts. It's all about spiritual lessons that we're needing right now so that our rough edges can get smoothed out. The audience will pull forth from you what you need to say, what it is they need to hear. And I try to remember that. It still doesn't take away my nervousness totally, but anyway. So I'm walking around. I'm writing these things down. And then she said to me, somewhere along the line, to all of us women, one God and... as the wave is one with the ocean, so am I one with God. And I knew she was telling the truth. I knew I had been lying to myself. And I still start lying to myself and still tell myself that this is not about unity and this is not about differences. Until I read in the big book or somebody reads it at the beginning of every meeting, thank God. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. In that period of time early in my sobriety, we walked through the steps as a group of women. And so I understood in the beginning that the first step basically was an invitation for me to accept myself unconditionally. That it was not going to do for me to accept myself when I learned how to drink, like accept myself unconditionally when I had figured out how not to have saggy boobs and a flat fanny. It would not do for me to accept myself as soon as I was situated in life, just as soon as I got around that next corner, whatever that next corner was, that I must accept myself unconditionally just as I am right now. Unconditionally, without any reservations. My next to my last relapse. You know why I knock? There were three elderly women living together. I believe they were sisters. One of them was getting out of bed, and her sister was watching her. She was sitting on the edge, and she said to herself, "Was I getting into bed or going out of bed?" And the first sister thought, "Oh my God, I hope I never get that bad." All of a sudden, she looked up and she saw her other sister coming down the stairwell on the first landing. And her sister was saying, "Was I going upstairs or downstairs?" She said, "Oh, now I know. They're just over the hill. I hope I never get that bad." And all of a sudden, I can't remember the punchline, but it's, was that the front door or the back door? What's the punchline? Oh, I know. She said... Go back 2 seconds. She said, "I hope I never get that bad." Was that the front door or the back door? Then my last relapse to date, which I know is just one drink away, when I was getting really smart alecky early in my sobriety, my sponsor turned around and she looked at me and she said, "Do you know you could drink again?" I mean, she was going to straighten me up right now. And I said to her, with a moment of truth, I said, "You know what? I know I could. I don't believe I will. I believe something is different this time. And I know I could. So today I tell you that today I am alive and sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't believe I'll drink today." The last time I got drunk was because of the second half of the first step. I'd come back from that particular institution to Chicago. And my man flew in from Baltimore. This is interesting. He, you know what, did me. You know what I mean. I mean, he screwed me. And then he told, this is the guy that told me, "If you will just get help for your alcohol." And I also was lying to myself, saying I couldn't live without him. Huh? So he said, "Okay, so it's over." And then I went to work. My dad took me to work. I was 28. My dad drove me to work, back to work. And the people, the juvenile detention home where I worked in Chicago said, "We think it's better you not come back here." Well, they hurt my feelings. They told me if I would get help for my alcoholism, they would hold my job open for me. And they said, "We think it's better that you not return. Can we have our keys back?" And I died. I died. I couldn't believe it. I was willing to go to any lengths for my sobriety, and what I found out later was I had two reservations, provided I get my man back and my job back, and it didn't happen. 9 years later, I realized that that man who was living in Baltimore screwed me and then took off, and that he was the screwer, and I was a screwee. I thought I had wrecked his life with my alcoholism. I thought I had wrecked our chances with my alcoholism. And so I blamed myself. That was just the way it was. So I got in trouble with the second half of the first step. And if you have any reservations, what we're not supposed to do is to keep it to ourselves. We're supposed to share it. That's what we do. When we have drunk dreams, we're supposed to share it. That's what I believe. And I don't think, for me anyway, this is my opinion on myself, that I have a drunk dream because I'm not sincere about my sobriety. I think I get drunk in my dreams because I have reservations that are coming to the surface to be touched by the Spirit and healed. I'm always in process of being healed. Which reminds me, this is out of sequence, I just really want to say this because I think it's the most important thing in the world. The sixth and seventh step says God is the change agent. God is the healer. So no matter how much I identify my old patterns, my character defects, my whatever that get in the way, no matter how much I try to be careful not to repeat old patterns from the past, I can't change me. So what I've learned today, 29 years, my wake-up call, is that I must enjoy right now. And then I turn the results over to God's handiwork. That's another thing that my sponsor said. My job is to be willing to go to any lengths for my sobriety. It's God's job to take care of the results. What does that mean? It means if I say to myself today, yes, I must have this thing that you have. If I say to myself today, I am willing to think that God is going to ask me to walk away from George. No, if George was in the way of my sobriety, much like I've gotten in the way of his, I would walk away. I would do anything to be sober and clean today. I know that unconditionally. I've known that one day at a time. And when I forget it, you remind me, because I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I go to meetings on a regular basis. I'm of service on a regular basis. All the time I'm of service, you know. That's the other thing. Marion said to me, of him who has much, much is expected. And so I knew that I had been graced with the most beautiful gift in the whole world, and I could never at this time. That's only because a couple of times I've burned out in sobriety. I just hit the wall. The first time, by the way, was about 9 years sober. I realized that I had really let myself lie to myself about how my life was over when that happened to me in losing that man and that in many ways, at many levels of truth, my life had just begun. So that's where I was at 9 years. And I was free, a new level of freedom. And then I married George. I was 37. He was, he says, you tell everybody how old I am. I said, oh, I know. It's just neat. He was, there are pictures from the wedding. George had just been widowed. He had married his childhood sweetheart, and they had birthed and raised by its proper name. I didn't know what was wrong with him. All I knew was that I could fix it. So in our wedding pictures, I'm like this. And he's like this. You know, anybody looking at that wedding picture would say, that poor guy. She really took advantage of him. And six kids that were devastated that their mom had died. Absolutely devastated. And a man who didn't even know if he wanted to live anymore. And so when those kids were lined up with baseball bats ready to beat me up, the minute I walked into his life and their lives and our marriage, I took it personally. I had tiny bad feelings. And what I've discovered then was that my easily hurt feelings are one of my most severe character defects because I just do weird things with it. I tell myself so many different lies. How could they love me? This is incredible. And I just got down to their level and fought back. And I got punier and punier and punier in terms of my heart and my mind and my spirit. Anyway, what I want to say to you about that is that 9 years sober and clean, I experienced another surrender. I was surrendered again. I went into a terrible depression and dark night of the soul. I became suicidal. My first step was I was willing to go to any lengths for my sobriety, for my life in sobriety, because I intuitively knew alcohol or a mood-altering drug would no longer be an option, but I wasn't sure that I might not want to kill myself again in sobriety. So my commitment had to be to life in sobriety with my first three steps. So I was thinking suicidally, and what happened was I was just reduced to sit down. I was terrified of sitting down. I was afraid if I ever sat down, I would never get back up again. I was forced to sit down. And it was during that period that my bulimia was lifted. God will do for me what I cannot do for myself. I fulfilled the conditions. I named it. I sought outside help, but I couldn't make it go away. Why? Because I couldn't make me go away. Why? Because I'm not the change agent God is. My bulimia was lifted. Powerful dark night of the soul. Terrible dark. And the most beautiful sunlight of the spirit came from that. Time passed, and we decided we would become an adoptive family. And we adopted, no, of course not one. Are you silly? We adopted four children, four hard-to-place children, Chippewa Cree, Spanish American, and Greek. Hard-to-place because they were ages 2, 3, 6, and cerebral palsy, and didn't walk on her own. And the social worker said, this is probably the closest you're going to come to having a baby. I'm sure I'm infertile because of all of that. So here I am saying to George, promise me you're not going to do this just to please me. Only do it if you want to do it. And he said, I would. Well, I must tell you, it's been a tremendous journey. I've had this ego squeezed out of me every day in ways that you couldn't even imagine. You remember the Red McGinnis surrender? I had the Tommy surrender, T-O-M-I, or the kid, that's a girl, one of our daughters, or the kids surrender. One night, they stole everything. They stole everything. One night, I went downstairs, and my top was missing. A beautiful top, Southwest. And I said, that's it. I've had it. And with that, I took off every stitch of clothing, every piece of jewelry. It was 10 o'clock at night. The other three children were in bed. Just Tommy and George were up. And this was nothing new to them, this kind of a scene. And I proceeded to everything, take it. And I emptied the garbage outside in my birthday suit. And I just walked around. But you know what? And it was the most powerful surrender. Because I let go absolutely again. Time passed. The kids have a lot of unresolved grief, as you can well imagine. Why are they racked with this disease? And they're angry. Everybody says in AA to them, oh, you are so lucky to have Mary and George as your new mom and dad. I say, lucky? How can they be lucky? What would it be like not to be raised by my own biological mom and dad? I don't know, because that's been my life, my experience. So they've been a challenge, to say the least. There's one redeeming feature. The children would run away. We have an open adoption, so we have interaction with the birth family. And they're related to a lot of people in Great Falls, Montana, and the Rocky Boy Reservation, and Japan. Because Native American people are nomadic. I didn't understand. They're nomadic, and so they move. They move. It's just biologically internal and integrated in them. And it's part of the article about the culture. So the other kids all the time wanted to police. I mean, they were treating me as poorly as I had treated my father. I could not believe it. And I went into a terrible depression. I wasn't sure that I wanted to live. I became extremely compromised. And during that dark night of the soul, my nicotine addiction was lifted. That which I had been trying to do for myself for years, absolute years. Another dark night of the soul led to the sunlight of the spirit, and it was absolutely phenomenal. So, what I want to say today is that if you're in a dark night of the soul, you already know this. If you've been in a dark night of the soul, you definitely know this, that as you move through and out, not overcome, not get around, not understand, as we move through the dark night of the soul in sobriety with the 12 steps, the help of sponsorship, regular attendance at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, we will come back out into the sunlight of the Spirit more intensified and glorified than we've ever known before. Why? Because the Big Book says we claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. I said to my physician at the time that my smoking addiction was lifted after he told me, you have an anxiety disorder and depression. Those are called mental illnesses in some circles. I said to him, you mean to tell me I'm alcoholic and drug addicted. I'm bulimic. I've been addicted to nicotine, and now you're telling me I have an anxiety disorder and depression. And he looked at me like I was crazy, and actually what he wrote, the diagnosis he wrote in his chart was FAC. Flat-ass crazy. What he said to me was, Mary, that's what makes you so special. And I knew he was telling me the truth with a capital T. I had been telling myself all these years, one day at a time, that's what made me sick. That's what's wrong with me. That's why I'm not good enough. That's why I'm too much. You know the routine. It goes on and on and on. What you have taught me is that which is, quote, wrong with me today is that which is holy and sacred and designed to help me see what is holy and sacred about who I am as a child of God. You have helped me to see that different is good, that there is a unity that is unspoken at times and always felt when we're open to the Spirit. You have taught me that a God of my understanding will manifest itself one day at a time in exactly the way I need, which has really taken George off the hook. Because I thought God was supposed to manifest himself as George. And one day, finally, in order to not beat him up anymore, I had to say to him, I don't know if you won't or can't meet my expectations and hear my needs, but what I realize, I've been doing you a disservice all along. I have put expectations on you, and I want to set you free, and I want to never have another expectation to the extent that I can do that as a human being from this day forward. Great expectancy I will have. Great expectancy that God will meet my needs each day, and that when those needs are being met through George or through you or through someone, someplace, something, some situation, some circumstance, I will be able to have passion and bliss and know that it is right, however God manifests in my life today. Those are the things that you have thanked me for coming here to share. I thank you.
I want to tell you about my medallions that I'm wearing. You know, I was going to stand up on a stool so everybody could see them, but y'all can see them after the meeting.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. I really want to thank Wally and all of those of you on the convention committee and all those who came before you on the convention committee to pave the way all these years, one day at a time, for this moment and for this weekend. I think this is a weekend about love affairs. I've been noticing everybody who's in love. Somebody just told me that he and his wife are spending their 23rd wedding anniversary. I believe that's what he said, 23rd wedding anniversary here this weekend. And I thought, my God. What a beautiful way to celebrate the love that has been able to flow through us because of this program. I would like to also thank you for the beautiful gift. I had a basket with some beautiful goodies in it, and that was just wonderful. Dave and Cheryl have gracious and available to us, as all of you have, really. I can't say enough thank you. It's such an honor. Wally, this is going to be a weekend I will always remember. Yeah. I knew it. You all have dirty minds. You know, I should have known it right off the bat. Friday night, I was trying to weave my way, and then I came across a man who had his arms on both chairs, his hands on both chairs next to him on either side. And I said, can I just get through? And I promise I'll give you your chair back. I won't try to take it. And he said, he lifted his arm up, and I got through. I hustled poor George through. And I turned around to him and I said, okay, you can put your hand back there. Naturally, somebody heard it. Made a big deal about it. I suppose you'd like to meet old George and poor George. This is poor George.
Stand up, George.
I'm 58. I was born in 43. So you can see that it's been kind of rough being married to me. Ed knows why. He caught me trying to do Armando's job for him Friday night. Hey, you guys, this is really swell. I'm originally from, Chicago, and then Duluth, Minnesota. So I'm going to tell you an Oli and a Sven joke. Oli and Sven decided they were going to go to the tavern on a Friday night, and Hilda wanted to go along. And Sven said, oh, Oli, do you mind? And he said, all right, good God. Anyway, they got there, and you know what happened. They got very, very intoxicated. All of a sudden, Sven was looking around, and he couldn't find his wife, Hilda. Not only that, Hilda.
It's catchy, isn't it?
No, I had it before I got here. Not only that, but he couldn't find his best friend, Oli. And he just started frantically looking around in the tavern. He went in the washrooms, nothing, nothing, nothing. Out the front door, nothing. Out the back door. And he was just about to come back in because there was nothing out there when he heard a funny sound coming from the back of his pickup truck. And he went over there, and oh, my God, there's Hilda, and there is Oli going to it. He staggered back through the tavern in the back hallway, and the bartender looked up, saw him coming, and he says, Sven, you are drunk. Sven said, you think I'm drunk? You should see Oli. He thinks he's me. Now... just as a way to qualify, I will tell you that I'm the Hilda in that story, and I never knew that I was not a Sven. You could have fooled me. The other thing is that that's kind of my story. I mean, it's a story of mistaken identification. I'm a woman who has had terror ever since I was 2 years old. That's what I think I put it at. Now, I thought I was terrified until last night in the lobby I met a young man, and I said, "Holy mackerel, you must be scared to death." And he looked at me, he said, "Why?" I said, "Because your hair is standing straight up on end." Several... What a beauty. My sponsor taught me one God, many faces, one life common to all. That's why I love to go somewhere where I'm not from, because I see God. Every time I look around, I see Sherry and I see our birth grandmother. Now, I want to say something about that. We are an adoptive family, George and I, and parents of four children. And their mother is still a child who had children. And their grandmother is still a child, a young woman. And so, Sherry, you don't remind me of a grandmother in terms of age. You remind me of the, oh, that's wonderful, of the love that shows forth through these eyes here in this room. Thank you. I'm sober since January 15th, 1972, thanks to the grace of God and the power of the 12 steps, as well as the fellowship of the Spirit. I have two home groups. One is the Mustard Seed Women's Group on Monday evening at 5:30. Shine Group at 6:30 a.m. And that both of those are wonderful meetings. And so when you're in Great Falls, Montana, or in the area, just look up Mary Huntington Lenner or George Lenner, L-E-H-N-E-R, in the phone book. You can stay with us and you can go to meetings with us. That's an open invitation. I wasn't in trouble. I'm Mary and I'm an alcoholic. I was not in trouble, as I say. up until then, I think I just came out of my mom's chute. Eager, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and I just knew that life, this world, was my oyster, and everything in it was mine. And about the age of two, I made my first decision based on self, and that self-centered fear that this was all fine and good, but it wouldn't last if I didn't prepare. And what I really needed was somebody's approval. Now, if you're the first child born to a mom and a dad, and your mom is already skittish. She already knows she's got a handful, having been married to this man, and she's never had a baby before. So I didn't want to bother her. In fact, I just said, "Hey, Ma, don't worry about it. I'll take care of you and me both," as I was coming out. So at the age of two, I said, "I know if my dad accepts me, loves me unconditionally, approves of me 100% of the time in 100% way, then I'll be okay." The selfishness, the gall. I didn't tell him, of course, so he didn't even know that was his job. I didn't know that he was simply a human being trying to do the best he could. And so we were off to a bad start here, and he and I. In 81, when George and I married, I said to my sister and my mother in the living room of my youngest sister's home in Youngstown, "Mom, did Dad and I always have a war going on?" And she looked at me like I was crazy. I was 37 at the time and 9 years sober and clean. And she said, "Mary, you were the apple of your father's eye." She was telling me the truth, that I had been lying to myself up until then. Changed everything. Also, the first, fourth, and fifth step I did changed everything. When I wrote down the fact that I resented my father because he was uncooperative, unaccepting, intolerant, judgmental. I found out in the fifth step process that the only way I could identify or recognize any of that was because it was within me. It hurt my feelings. Which is another really hard thing for me still. I can remember one of the first speakers I ever heard in Duluth, Minnesota, a woman with black hair. Just, you probably know her. I can't remember her name, but I know that she was well known. And she said, you know, I don't think I'm ever going to end having my feelings hurt or looking for your approval. And so she gave me permission, I think, right then, along with my sponsor, to be a human being before I'm anything else. And that has saved my bacon so many times, to tell you the truth. I mean, I understand that the fact of my alcoholism is probably the most powerful, important fact of my life today, in addition to the fact of a loving God that works and operates in a daily way and gives me 12 steps to follow based on spiritual principles so that I can meet whatever comes today. And the fact of the matter is, I never knew I was a human being. That was the other thing I lied to myself about. I thought I was the worst of the worst and the best of the best, and that all started from the age of 2 on up. So my first unhealthy dependence was to approval. My next unhealthy dependence was probably to excitement. Because something happened to me when I got excited. It was like a tension reliever. And so that was the beginning of learning to live these. And then I suppose the next, I'm trying to think the first time I was sexual, either, you know, self-pleasuring or with another person, and I think it was probably, I'm just telling the truth. I'm trying not to lie. I think it was before I had my first drink. So I learned that that kind of a sexual pleasure was absolutely stress reducing and freedom producing. And so that was another unhealthy dependence. Not, it wasn't unhealthy. It was just the way I sought it that got a little unclever. For my first drink, it's only 25 after 6. Oh. When I reached for my first drink, something absolutely miraculous and magical happened. And I don't know if it was a first, if I had one or two beers that day. We had moved from Chicago up to the northern suburb. I was now at New Trier High School in the middle of my freshman year. I think that's what made me alcoholic. And I've heard other people say, that is very traumatic for us, you know. Oh, anyway, I just wanted to be included. I couldn't figure out why people were kind of giving me some distance. I think it was because up there where we moved, all of the girls had beautiful little peroxide streaks in their hair, and a little flip up or a little flip down, and they all wore dyed to match wool angora skirt and sweaters in pastels, either pink or lime green or yellow. And the men were jocks, and I had black. I had my black sweater buttoned backwards, was on my back, the buttons, and a long skirt, and I walked, you know, and I was a hoodlum. All of a sudden, one day, I'm walking home because there was a. We had this week of tests, and they had breaks in between each test. So I'm walking home, and a carload of people come by, and they say, "Hey, we're going to a party." First time I had been included in that new community, and I said, "You bet! Oh yeah." And so we went down to an Al Capone casino that was in ruins on Lake Michigan. And somebody broke out a beer and handed it to me. Did I drink too? I don't know. But I do know this, that when I drank that beer, immediately I felt full, whole. Not only that, but I was smart as a whip, clever as can be, and I didn't stammer or lisp. On top of that, I didn't give a rip what you thought of me. In fact, I wasn't sure that I approved of you. And it was the most freedom-producing miracle I had had in my life up until that moment. And I knew intuitively that it was something, another lie, I could control. That whenever life got a little rough, I could just take a little bit of that liquid courage, liquid serenity, liquid thrill and bliss. And that's what I made my commitment to. That was really my very first real love affair. And all went well for a couple of weeks. And then I started doing silly things, you know, really silly things. I can remember being sexual when I didn't intend to be sexual, running away from home, making an absolute commotion, developing these terrible tales about my wicked father. I'll tell you, our kids are getting even for my father. They're wicked tales about my father. And I just created more and more stuff so that I could justify continuing to take a drink. And then you wouldn't get on my back, because you were starting to get on my back. You were starting to not complain or criticize, but you were pointing some things out. And you'd say, oh, you were really funny last night until about 10. And I'd say, oh, you thought so, huh? What did you like the best? And they say, well, when you got on top of the table and started dancing, that was pretty hilarious. Oh, uh-huh. But then when you jumped on Harry's shoulders and broke his back, that wasn't funny. So I learned to interrogate you to find out what I had done, because I was having blackouts on a regular basis. I was drinking more, and I, of course, I didn't know that was a red flag for alcoholism. I just thought I was just too cool to move. I could drink all of you under the table, and little did I know. But towards the end of my drinking, I would take a little thimbleful of vodka, and I would be totally drunk on that little, because my body wasn't metabolizing anything. I was a daily drinker, and I drank a lot. And my body was no longer metabolizing. So I was really pitiful. The other thing, too, is I must tell you, I was in professional circles, it's called a hero child, because I was the first to make my parents a family. And I was also a scapegoat, because I was developing alcoholism. And so I was always running around asking if you'd like, a cup of coffee. Can I get you anything? Do you want me to help you get into the next room? Can I do your homework assignment for you? What can I do for you? I'm just here to please. I'm just here to be helpful. And I kept getting absolutely crucified everywhere I go, which has also been a pattern that I have experienced up to, including through today. So I kind of get kind of praised and slapped around. So it's not alcoholism, it's just an identity crisis I'm going through. I am a chronic relapser. I would have a day or a minute or a week or maybe even a month, never any longer than that, before I'd be back drinking again. My first experience with Alcoholics Anonymous, a man who was deeply in love with me, a man who was so in love with me, that he told me he thought I had alcoholism. He was a year ahead of me at the university, that I think you need some help, and I'm going to make sure you get to a meeting. And he took me to a meeting. It was in a church basement. And man, you people were just beautiful. Shiny eyes, great smiles, the enthusiasm, the spirit was just intense. And I said, and I meant it truly, I was so grateful you had found this miracle. And if I ever got that bad, you know, by the time I got back to I believed truly that I was too far gone, that I was too bad, that I was not capable of this beautiful thing, and that I would never, ever be able to get it. You knew differently, because you knew that we just live on the basis of hope. We don't know. What do we know? I know nothing. That's the other thing I've lied to myself all my life about. I thought I've known so much. I have known so little. I ended up, and the first time I was there, this was about my 15th or 16th treatment center and detox center. And by the time I ended up there the second time, I was there for 6 months. They saw fit. It hurt my feelings. They saw fit to refer me on to a women's halfway house program in Duluth, Minnesota, called the Marty Mann Halfway House. And I called my mother, and I said, Mom, do you know what? They want me to go on up, instead of coming back to Chicago like I did the last time, because you and Dad were having marital difficulties, they want me to go to Duluth, Minnesota, to a halfway house for alcoholic women. And she said, oh, Mary, don't you think you've put in enough time? With that, my dad was on the other extension and said, they haven't led yet. I think it's a mighty fine idea. So I knew my goose was cooked. I knew I'd had it. So at about 98 pounds, with skinny hair, gray skin, a falling down alcoholic, I still fall down a lot, by the way, a falling down alcoholic, I went to a halfway house in Duluth, Minnesota, and I was there for another 14 months. So I was institutionalized for 20 months. I know it's hard for you to really even imagine that. You believe me, don't you? Shoo. Anyway, so I had a lot of time, and I'm going to really focus on that a lot this morning. Why? Because that's where the foundation was laid. I mean, it was just an incredible thing. I mean, it was my first year and really my first 2 years that I think have been absolutely the springboard for the rest of my life. And I told myself, of course, and I told you that the problem with me was alcoholism. Once I got the message, that was a lie, I told myself. And I almost set my first sponsor straight, Marion. She said that alcoholism is a physical compulsion. No, alcoholism is a physical compulsion to drink because of a psychological obsession that condemns us to die if we do. Marion said, alcoholism is a self-made excuse to bring us to our knees to say yes to a spiritual journey we've been trying to avoid. And I said, oh, no, it isn't. It's a psychological obsession matched by... But I was smart. I'm Mensa. I was smart. I just said it to myself. I did not say it out loud.